Tonight on Arena, Andrew Flynn and Anna Healy on the Irish premiere of Jez Butterworth's play The Ferryman, and Paddy Bush on his new book The Amargin Step. +51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena, and you can watch us on rte.ie/arena. Jez Butterworth's play The Ferryman is set in rural County Armagh during the fraught summer of 1981. The story takes place against the backdrop of the IRA hunger strikes and the deep scars of the Northern Irish Troubles. The heart of the play is the Kearney family, whose preparations for the annual harvest are upended by the resurfacing of a long-buried tragedy, the body of Seamus Kearney, one of the so-called disappeared. The play's premiere in London was met with critical acclaim, earning Butterworth both an Olivia Award and a Tony Award for Best Play. It was also met with some controversy over the portrayal of the Irish in that production. But now The Ferryman makes its way to Irish audiences in a new production directed by Andrew Flynn. Delighted to be joined in studio by Andrew this evening, along with Anna Healy, who plays the fiercely political Aunt Auntie Patricia, I'm sure she is, rather than Aunt.
Oh no, she gets Aunt Pat.
Oh, Aunt Pat, she's very specific about that. There'll be none of your auntie with Pat.
No.
Just to give the background to the play itself and the story here, if you would, Andrew. As I said, 1981, we're at a very specific and difficult time in terms of the Northern Irish Troubles. The hunger strikes are happening at that period in time. And then the discovery of this body in County Louth, in fact.
Yeah, I mean, it's a hotbed of activity, 1981. I think when the play opens, 9 men have already died on hunger strike. And during the play, a 10th man dies. So that's the backdrop to, I suppose, what he's written, an epic family drama. And it is dramatic, yet very, very human. And I think what he's done is he's crafted a play that is a love story, but it's set against a political war, I guess, and the trauma that entails. You have Quinn Kearney, who's the head of this family, who has walked away from his Republican past and is trying to raise a young family. And his brother has gone missing 10 years earlier in 1971. I guess one of the disappeared. And as the play opens, we learn Seamus's body has been found. And the play kind of kicks off from there. It's a fascinating story because it was based on a true story.
Jez Butterworth's own wife. It's something from her family background.
And something she didn't know about. Was watching a documentary, saw a photo of her uncle and realised he was one of the disappeared. I think she thought he had been killed in a car crash.
Yeah, this is the story I think she'd been told.
Yeah, so that's the starting point. And I guess, I mean, what I'm finding out about him is just how good a writer he is because, you know, I don't know if I went into it realising how rhythmic his writing is, you know, but as we're doing it, certain things, for example, you know, in an effort to find the truth of the play, we realised he uses the word Palace Road, but it should be Palace Street. And but when you change that word, it actually changes the rhythm of a speech. The starting point for us, we're making a play, not a documentary, but also aware it is controversial. It was, I suppose, made in England by an English director, by an English company. But this production, what we're trying to do is to see the play through Irish eyes and with an Irish sensitivity.
And I'll come back to how you've done that. But let's get a sense, Anna, of who Aunt Pat is, now that I know exactly how I should address her.
Aunt Pat is a maiden aunt who lives in the extended family with the Kearneys on the farm. In my own family, we had these maiden aunts. They peppered the families of all of my generation.
And you'd be from in it. You're from the
North. I'm from the North. I'm from Derry. Yeah. And I'm from a family that has a mix of a rural father and a city mother. My mother came from what you call the sandwich fill in between the Bogside and the Creggan. So she came from Marber Terrace. And so I would have an absolute life experience of the family that we have here, yeah, you know, and the boys from Derry come down to Armagh to help with the harvest. And they kind of bring that gritty violence off the streets of Derry at the time with them into this little idyll. Auntie Pat or Aunt Pat, as she actually is. And we have an Uncle Pat as well. Classic just Irish to, again. Yeah,
just to confuse matters.
Just to confuse everybody. She is a staunch Republican. And she is all the time listening in to what's happening in the hunger strike. She's listening to the politics that are coming in from England via, you know, it's Margaret Thatcher, let them die time. And she's just not buying anything of these the younger couple and the children trying to paper over the cracks and live in the country idyll in South Armagh.
Yeah, so as far as Aunt Pat is concerned, there is no moving on. You have to hold on to the bitterness
and the struggle and the, you know, and throughout the play she erupts here and there and gets squashed back by Quinn Kearney, who's the male figurehead of the younger
played
family.
Played by Aaron McCusker in this production.
Who's fantastic.
And Charlie McKenna plays his wife then, Kathleen.
That's right. Yeah. And what we have in spades, it's a given, is we've two people from Armagh playing people from Armagh. I mean, I'm not saying you have to be exact.
Of course,
But you can't argue with that. They have the rhythm of the speech. They have the lived experience. They know the communities.
Yeah, well, I might be claiming a bit of Charlene now as Monaghan as well.
Oh, yeah. But again, that's the issue of the place. It's not 1,000 miles away. And until 1921, sure, it was all the one thing. And then suddenly it's you're up there, we're down here. And, you know, and that's what we're doing as well.
So I think you both saw that production that, as I say, it won an Olivier Award and went on to win a Tony Award. Mm. And in fact, it was Laura Donnelly, isn't that her name? Jez Butterworth's wife. She played the character of Kathleen within this, you know, which you're talking about authenticity. You can't get much more authentic than that. No. I guess you saw that production, Andrew. What struck you about it at the time? Apart from now you'll tell me how great Jez Butterworth's writing was, but did you get the sense that people were giving out about this, you know, kind of the fighting Irish, the drinking Irish, and the portrayal of the Irish on stage being problematic?
I mean, I saw it and I really enjoyed it. Mm. I can absolutely see some of the criticisms.
Me too.
I think there was, I don't know, was it the writing or how it was produced? I did feel some of the things were sent up and kind of created a stereotype that I didn't quite believe or felt. I won't say I was offended, but I did have issue with.
Yeah.
And I mean, sitting down and reading it, when I sat down to read it, and with that in mind, it's not even that we're making major changes. We're just, I suppose, trying to find an honest production and not go down that road, not play up to any stereotypes. I think probably, if I'm honest, maybe there was too much alcohol in the first production. It was kind of excessive at 7 o'clock in the morning as you're about to harvest the crop.
Yeah.
So the changes are small, but I wasn't born in the north of the country and never really lived there, but we have half our cast have. And I mean, we're relying heavily on their lived experience. And I have to say it's been phenomenal for me.
Well, you have lived experience, certainly, of Northern Ireland, Anna. And also you saw the production and you were pointing in agreement to Andrew as he made the point there about something perhaps in the production. What did you think of it at that time?
I found it entrancing and absolutely enchanting. But at the bottom of it, I felt there was a slightly chocolate boxy Paddy Wackery here and there that is the misunderstanding of the production, not the writing. I think there's a lot of humanity and love and but at the same time heartbreak and violence in the play that I didn't see the violence. I didn't believe it in the production I saw in London, but I think we're going to believe it in our production.
I would say too, Anne, I mean, as an Irish actor based in London, you've probably seen more than one production of that nature, I would guess.
Yeah, yeah. I've just been in a production of O'Casey's Juno and the Peacock.
This is the one with Mark Rylance.
Yeah. And I'd have to say I had a fabulous time. There were 9 Irish in the cast and then 3 non-Irish, Rylance himself, J. Smith Cameron, American, and
what was he playing?
And that's a woman. That's the woman.
Sorry, beg your pardon.
She played Juno.
Juno,
and also a fabulous British actor called Paul Hilton, whose parents are Irish, who played Joxer.
Joxer. So the three central roles.
They were phenomenal to start off with, but there was something in that production where we the Irish went, no, don't misunderstand us with the drunkenness and the party scene in Act Two, which is always off key. Don't have it a big dancey Kayleigh thing, you know. They say cliche or born a truth. And we do, wherever we go, we end up singing and drinking, or some of us do.
Yeah.
But
but we also do lots of things.
We do lots of other things as well.
Singing and not drinking.
That are not drinking, is right. Yeah. So to portray that as our predominant is just boring.
Did you take over as Juno one night?
Yes, I did. Did somebody tell you that?
There you go.
I did. I had a great time.
My spies are everywhere.
Yeah, yeah. Just one. But one night.
Fitting into that production in that nature, what kind of a challenge was that then? I mean, or did you find yourself having to kind of say, "Well, look, I'm here for the night because there's a problem. I have to fit."
No, well, because I was playing Maisie Madigan in the production. And actually, and you know this, I spent the last 18 months doing O'Casey because I did the Druid trilogy, but I wasn't in Juno. So I had it in my head. It was a massive challenge to play against him because...
Against Mark Rylance.
Yes.
Was he doing a kind of a Chaplin thing on
it? He was. He got obsessed with...
Charlie Chaplin.
Charlie Chaplin, the music hallness of things and... sort of brought it into a kind of a, broke the fourth wall, so he was chatting to the audience to the point where you forgot the violence that was in the streets outside in Dublin at the time of this family drama. So we have the same thing again. Yeah. We have a family drama set against the backdrop of a political situation that's out of everybody's control.
And probably the pinnacle of that, you know, the hunger strike, it's bang in the middle of
I mean
I work off the actor and the cast are just phenomenal. I think everyone has gone into this with the same desire to just be honest and serve the writing, and I think if you do that and if you earn, you can have all that if it's earned.
And just briefly then on what about the rest of the Irish cast in that production of Juno?
Fabulous. It was flawless.
Was it difficult to go with that taking it? Did audiences buy it?
They did. I mean, he's so phenomenal that he could, I don't know, he could blow his nose and everybody would be delighted. But and the rest of the production, there was a lot to love in that production. And we formed a very strong company and he is the most generous leader of a company. Back to the hunger strike, I don't think I told you this. I was in West Belfast working
at the time of the
hunger strike.
In 1981,
with banging drums, burning buses, a lot of heartbreak and pain.
Yeah, I remember the bin lids.
The bin lids.
In Monaghan, the night that Kieran Doherty died.
Yeah.
You could hear the bin lids being banged.
And I think Quinn in the play has kind of, he's removed himself from that world. And in a way, he's built this farm trying to protect his children from it.
He has.
But it's kind of, it's impossible to.
It just seeps in under the door, you know.
Anna touched on it there, though, when she was talking about this, you know, in terms of Juno, the family drama and the big political stuff and the violence that was happening outside the door. This is exactly the same kind of challenge. What's the balance there, Andrew, between the family drama of the Carnies and the huge big political background of those hunger strikes?
I mean, it's a long play. It's 3 hours, but it moves. And I guess what's really interesting is an awful lot of the political stuff that comes in through the younger generations. And I don't think Quinn is aware at all in the play. He's more interested when the play opens, really, in saving the harvest, in providing a good life, a better life for his children. But it's amazing. You can't stop the rumours. And even like the youngest of children early enough in the play has a question about her father's past. So right from the start, that wall or that defence to try and keep the political sphere out, it's kind of constantly threatening. And a bit like the poor man's body that resurfaces in the bog, it kind of resurfaces in the house. And I mean, the writing, it goes from... it's extremely funny one moment and then in a heartbeat. Anna has a scene where it is really funny and light and warm and in a heartbeat it changes. Mm. And that is constantly happening throughout the play.
Yeah.
And Anna, you were saying about Auntie Pat, or that about Aunt Pat, that in fact she won't let go. She whereas the younger generation might want to move on, and Quinn is kind of in his 40s or thereabouts, isn't he?
Yes.
As the father of the household. While that generation might say, look, we need to move on in whatever way they want to do it, but they want to kind of get beyond where they are at that moment in time. That kind of nature that Aunt Pat has to need to hold on to the, not, I'm saying old grudges, but that's not fair to her,
no,
I guess.
She, in a way, she feels she's warning them not to think it's gone. It's you know, that it's important to be accountable, to stand up, to have your views, to speak your views, to not let things fade away. I mean, when you were speaking just now, I was thinking of Sleeping Beauty. The thimble gets in, doesn't it? Is it Sleeping Beauty where, like, they put her to sleep for 100 years, and you know, because she pricks her finger on a thing. But it's so the young, as you say, the young bring it in. It's like there's no, it's inescapable, and she's like the messenger. You know, beware the eyes of Mars. She's saying, "Do beware. Don't be taking in the Englishman who's there. Don't be." Her views are very binary. There's very black and white, right and wrong. And
what's fantastic is Brigitte Nocton plays a character called Aunt Maggie Faraway, who either has Alzheimer's or dementia. And she drifts in and out of the play. You don't really know how much she hears. But she tells, halfway through the play, she tells a story about Pat that completely, you suddenly go, oh my God. We now understand why she's so staunch.
Yeah.
But Jess Butterworth is an English playwright.
Yes.
You know, to what extent, because it's called The Ferryman, and you're talking about the Brigitte Nocton character there as the Aunt Margaret and Auntie Maggie.
Aunt Maggie, yes.
Aunt Maggie far away. There's a mythological aspect to this. Has he picked up on other Irish playwrights? Has he picked up on a linguistic style of others, perhaps?
Definitely picked up on other playwrights. I mean, you can see the influence Friel has had on him. There's no doubt about that. But that may have been a criticism of it. I think he does it really brilliantly. It's an epic play, a family drama, but it shows you the trauma of conflict. It shows you the complexity of conflict.
Yeah.
And just Quinn Kearney constantly said in the play, you're a good man, he's a good man. He tries to do right. But his background, his upbringing and his very, it's almost like it's in his blood.
Yeah.
He can't escape it. And it does come in through the door to a very epic finale.
It does.
And the play kind of moves like that. It's constantly building. The tension is constantly rising. And the big thing for me with the play is, irregardless of how much he's tapped into other writers' linguistic, he writes characters really well.
He does.
And the characters, you really love, you fall in love with the characters.
And did you find an authenticity within the language? Because this is the language of your people.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, Derry isn't that far away from Armagh either. But this is your own.
My granny's from Monaghan.
Oh, well, there you go. Knew there was something good about you.
So, yeah, it's definitely, with the day we read it, I thought, oh my God, this is such a relaxing thing to feel somebody who's felt the rhythm of speech. Now, here and there, he gilds the lily a bit and uses too many swear words, and I think, no.
Well, and have you done a bit of cutting?
Yeah, a little bit of rubbing out here and there, just like, oh, no, I'm not saying that. Just a tiny bit.
And will he visit? Will he come to see it?
Hopefully.
Have you been in touch with him?
Yeah, hopefully. I mean, it's a huge play, and to be doing a play with, like, in our cast, we have 23 actors because there's a...
Brilliant to be doing a play with that size
well,
of cast.
It's frightening, Sean.
And
a baby.
Maybe not for the production company.
We have a baby, a goose, and a rabbit on stage.
Real life?
Real life acting rabbits.
Yeah. No, it is huge. And it's rare to see now where you see that scale of production. So we're excited. We're kind of halfway through. We're coming halfway through week three. And we have another 2 weeks in the rehearsal, which is the longest I've ever spent in a rehearsal room. Mm. But it'll need it. It's a big
epic
drama.
Even as you're describing the size of cast there and that whole idea of the family drama and the family up against society, Tom Murphy springs
completely,
to mind.
And
you know, Whistle in the Dark, for example.
Yes.
And another set of Carnies.
Yeah, another set of Carnies.
Which has to be intentional, doesn't it? I mean, you've got the nod to Friel, the nod to...
That's what I'm wondering then. So would you think that is an intentional nod?
I think so.
But he does it in a way that it's not... I think it's a respect thing more than anything. And they're the storytellers of our country. And I think he's it's a nod to that, I think.
I think so. Yeah.
And it's epic, and there's a moral in the there's a moral in the play, I think. Like, I can't give away the ending, but some of the lines at the ending, I find, even when we did the reading that day, it's kind of chilling.
Yeah.
And it's something to do with the build of the, it's operatic in its in the way the play builds.
Big scale.
Yeah, but I can't. The amount of humour and fun and heart in the play is huge. Yeah.
Well, it sounds fascinating, I have to say. Looking forward to getting to see it in the new year.
That's it.
Andrew Flynn and Anna Healy with me there. The Ferryman will be at the Gaiety Theatre from the 27th of January right through until the 8th of March. GaietyTheatre.ie for full details there. Let us go now to Music for Galway's annual Midwinter Festival. It arrives every January as a welcome highlight of the season. Next month, the weekend long festival celebrates the works of Maurice Ravel on the eve of the 50th anniversary of the composer's birthday, which will be in March 2025. He was born 150 years before that. Work it out for yourself. Pianist François Xavier Poisat will perform the music in Galway. Born in 1989, Swiss, French and Chinese origins, François Xavier graduated from the Geneva and Hamburg Conservatory, from the Juilliard School in New York and from the Santa Cecilia Accademia in Rome. Currently on a mission to record Ravel's complete works. He is not currently on a mission. I think he has done it at this point in time. Delighted to welcome François Xavier Poisat as he joins me on the line now from Geneva. Have you got all the piano works finished at this point? I thought I came across the entire piano works on Spotify today, François.
Yes, it was already published in October, so it's very fresh. It's just out of the oven for the last 2 months. Yes.
What sort of a dish? How difficult is it to cook a complete Ravel?
It is as difficult as you can imagine, and I needed 20 years of preparation. Of course, I didn't only play Ravel for this whole time, but since I'm a teenager, I already knew I would do it one day, so I prepared it on the very long run.
Well, as you said, it took you 20 years to prepare it. I was thinking, you know, given that you were born in 1989, I mean, to have done anything else at the same time as such an enormous project is quite extraordinary. Ravel and the piano, how well versed in your instrument is Ravel, François Xavier?
Like many great composers, Ravel wrote from the piano. He was a pianist himself, pretty good pianist actually. And of course, the piano for such a composer, such a genius, is a very good instrument to write everything from, because you can really try everything out. You have so much possibilities on the keyboard. And my project was the opportunity to give very good and big idea of Ravel's music, because the piano is very central in his work. And Ravel did, of course, a lot of orchestral music as well, but from the piano you have almost everything already.
Well, let's go to some of what I will refer to as the miniature pieces, or the chamber pieces, to start us out on a little journey through some of Ravel's music. His Menuet sur le nom de Haydn, a minuet on the name of Haydn. So he takes the letters of Haydn's name here and composes a piece around it.
Yes, absolutely. It was like a kind of musical game, and he did it twice in his life. And this gives instrumental musical motives that is not so interesting, but what Ravel does out of it is a wonderful miniature.
Yeah, and I mean, H is sometimes how the note B flat is written. It's written as H. A, I understand, as a note. D, I understand, as a note. What did he do for Y and N in Haydn?
Actually, it's like taking the first seven letters and repeating it until it reaches the Y, and then you get one note.
Ah, right. So he just played around. In fact, he composed a piece. He composed a piece and used Haydn as a kind of an excuse. Let's have a listen. And this is from your complete recordings, François Xavier. This is the minuet based in and around the name Haydn. Thank you. And the opening section there, almost all of the minuet on the name of Haydn, the composition of Maurice Ravel, as played by François-Xavier Poiset from his complete recordings of the piano works of Haydn. And François will be at Music for Galway's Midwinter Festival in the first month of next year. It strikes me about Ravel, often the thing that's spoken about him, François, is this idea of the miniature, the small little thing. He loved the delicacy of the small thing, and even the little twists and turns that he does in that piece, just as that final section that we heard, when it moves from something fairly straightforward into a much more modern feel with those really unusual harmonies.
Yes, as you say, the miniature is a very important musical form for Maurice Ravel, and not only miniature, but the concision is one of the most important idea in Maurice Ravel. Nothing is written too much, and he always takes out everything when he's not sure that it's just perfectly written, and some pieces like this one are thus very short.
And what about then, of course, the piece that everybody knows, Bolero? How does that fit into his miniature kind of mind? I suppose it is really only one phrase repeated over and over again, isn't it?
Absolutely, and Bolero is a real exception. It's the only piece that is repeating in his whole complete work, and this is the only piece that is repetitive. And the genius of the Bolero is in the orchestration.
Yeah. Of course, and let's go to one of the orchestral pieces as well, because one of the great skills of Ravel was quite definitely as an orchestrator. And lest we think on the basis of the minuet that we just heard that everything in Ravel is gentle and calm and smooth and easy, let's have a listen to the third movement of the Piano Concerto in G. Section there from the opening movement of the Piano Concerto in G Major, as played by François-Xavier Poiset, who's speaking with me on the programme this evening. I'm really struck when I listened to that piece, particularly the section that we just closed off on there, François-Xavier. It was Gershwin wanted Ravel to teach him about orchestration, but Ravel was having none of it. And there's a real feel of Gershwin, I think, particularly in that third movement in some of the piano forms that we get.
Yes, absolutely. This was written right after Ravel traveled to America for the first time. He was very influenced by jazz, and he met Gershwin there, and he really liked Gershwin's music. So you really feel in that music so much dancing elements and so many upbeat accents and rhythm. Mm. It really makes me want to dance.
And you know, of course, you know what Ravel's response was to Gershwin when Gershwin said, "Can I come and study with you?" Tell us.
Yes, it's a funny anecdote. And Ravel asked back to Gershwin, "How much do you earn every year?" And Gershwin said a number, and then Ravel said, "That's much more than what I earn. I will take lessons from you."
Yeah. And he also said, "Why would you bother being a second-rate Ravel when you could be a first-rate Gershwin?" Which was kind of a backhanded compliment in some ways.
Yes, I heard both versions.
Yes,
actually,
In terms of what you're playing in Galway, will you be playing any of the orchestral works, or will it be purely, well, are you playing the concerto, for example? Are you playing both chamber works and the bigger orchestral works?
Unfortunately, we don't have an orchestra, but I have amazing chamber musicians, colleagues to play with me. So I will play, for example, the trio. I will play some solo music like Gaspard de la Nuit, one of the most virtuosic and impressive works of Ravel. Some forehands with Fingon Collins, the great Irish pianist. And it will be a wonderful program.
Yeah, in fact, the four-handed, one of the four-handed works, and when we talk about four hands, will it be two pianos, or will the two of you be squeezing up beside each other on the piano stool? Is it one piano or two?
It's only one piano. We'll have to squeeze a little, but that's the fun in the in the four hands pieces.
They might stretch and buy a slightly bigger stool for you for Mother Goose.
Yes, hopefully.
Mother Goose strikes me and the suite of pieces that Ravel wrote for this child story in many ways. It has the sound of simplicity of it. I'm not sure how simple it is to play.
Actually, it's pretty simple to play. The music is always hard because it's so fine, so refined. But the notes, it's the only piece from Havel that were written for children, so everybody can play it after a few years of piano practice. It's a real exception. But of course, when we are, sometimes the easiest pieces are the hardest for the professional to play, because then it just has to be perfect.
And how typical would you say this L'Adorinette from the Mother Goose suite is of the piano music of Ravel?
So L'Adorinette is very much inspired by Asian or Chinese music, and it has a very heavy use of the pentatonic scale, and we play on the lot of scales only on the black notes, and this gives an idea of something Chinese or Japanese.
Yeah, with exactly that kind of Eastern feel of it. We'll listen to a little bit of that to finish up, but thanks for being with us this evening, Francois.
Thank you.
That's François Xavier Poiset, and here he is with a little section of the L'Adorinette from Mother Goose. Of the L'Adorinette from Mother Goose, the suite of Maurice Ravel and François Xavier Poiset, one of the pianists performing there. He will be performing that piece along with Finian Collins and many other chamber pieces at Music for Galway's Midwinter Festival, which takes place on the weekend of the 17th of January 2025. That's next year. Full details on musicforgalway.ie. Yeah, I mentioned it just before that piece, but let us reiterate it. It really is great news about the two Academy Award nominations for NECAP. Best International Feature, which is absolutely brilliant, and Best Original Song. Of course, we are great fans of NECAP. We had Makara on with us at the time of the release of the album, and Michael Fassbender was on with us as well at the time of the release of the film. So we will be very interested in how that all goes. Let's have a little listen to them.
I got a point to be proven to myself. Sitting too long, getting moldy on the shelf, cause I'm too far gone when it comes to mental health. Rather be sick in the head with a little bit of wealth. Time to tender right a glotty cool a stranchera. My time can yan and dini do sit down chara. I get me life and not get shit we can't. Never go live your guest, I can show him.
Shots again, to your doing yeah, they're doing it to you constantly. An individual is surely what you want to be. You're born to sound good, live your fantasy. Before they eat you up, they're pettier than lafagy. Fun sucker, BG, Grisakas, clean it off, blind mucker. They'll be pushed back, but relax, shocker. Cause shoulders feel set, they heal at the uns, brother.
It's a philosophy, me like I'm gone, no more real. Goal of anger and inhale a power and TV steed. To be a fact of me, because Khabib wrote how the story is. So it's how it's meant to be, so got your call. Clean out hands, not hands for him. Hagen shit, toss him around, Hagen toss her, toss her. They're huge to the closer, so talk, shine, shine, score. New machine is faster.
I got a point to be proven to myself. Sitting too long, getting moody on the shelf. Cause I'm too far gone when it comes to mental health. But I be sick in the head with a little bit of wealth. I'm a tender, but I got a coolest trancher. My time came to you, and then you need to sit down, chara. I give me life, and I can shit, we can't check. Then I go live by your guest, I can show him.
I pray to the
the devil, let me be rich instead. He said,
you'll no longer be skin, but you'll be sick in the head. Need two reels to stride and I'll go get the big
sick in the head, the title of the song. Now shortlisted for the best original song at the Oscars, and the film itself, Kneecap, shortlisted for best international feature. Congratulations, or gorgeous, I suppose I should say, to all involved in that. Paddy Bush lives in Kerry. He's a poet and translator in both Irish and English. He's published 13 collections of poetry, the most recent being Peripheral Vision. However, Paddy is with me this evening to talk about his latest book, The Amargan Step, which he calls refers to as a collection of history, travel writing, folklore and mythology, a book of homage and gratitude to the place he lives in, the Iveragh Peninsula. Paddy, great to have you with us this evening. And you're talking
about
the peninsula. Yes, all its physical beauty and all of those things, but really you're talking about it almost as an imaginative space.
Yeah, I think landscape is the idea of landscape in terms of shaping something and apprehending it is essentially a human construct and a human imaginative construct. I mean, if you know, you go to the Aran Islands, you look at certain cliffs there and you know that Singh came there and sat up there, you know, getting inspiration for all his work, in and then later interviewed people, all this sort of stuff. It contributes to how we relate to a place, the same way as knowing a person's personality contributes to how we relate to that person.
And in terms of the Iveragh Peninsula, then, the title of the book is The Amargan Step. That, for the uninitiated and for those who aren't aware of the importance of Amargan in terms of poetry and in terms of the peninsula, maybe you'd explain that to us.
Yeah, Amargan, according to the Leabhar Gualla, the mythological history of early Ireland, was the leader, the poet, the lawmaker of the first Gaelic people to come to Ireland from Galicia in northern Spain. And it said that as he, you know, at the first successful landfall was in at Ballinskellig's Bay, and the Leabhar Gualla tells us that as he stepped ashore, he recited the poem in which he identified with the surrounding landscape and its flora, its fauna. He identified with it rather than claimed it as a possession.
And I guess that for you as a poet is a wonderful thing, that that identification with that landscape, with that place, which is so much a part of who you are, was made so far back in mythological and historical time.
Yes, indeed. It's you know, when I found out about it shortly after I came here, I was fascinated by it, and I could go to the end of my back garden, which is a clay cliff eroding into the sea, and look down on the very spot. Possibly, I mean, it's a fairly big bay, but it could have been just below my house that Amargan arrived and made this, you know, hugely consequential step. And I think it's a step that if we take it imaginatively and we identify ourselves with our surroundings and the health of ourselves as being the health of our surroundings, we will find it easier to give them the care and attention and respect that our neglect of that aspect of them has led us to in the crisis we're currently in.
And that crisis is very much, there are lots of aspects to it in many ways, but I think the climate crisis and the future of the planet are very much at the heart of what you're speaking about in this new book. You have one of the poems that you said you might read first, I think, addresses that aspect of things directly, Paddy.
Yes, it's a poem called Amargan in 2020, which I wrote at the beginning of that year. I remember at the time there were fierce bushfires in Australia and, of course, the whole climate change. So Amargan in 2020.
his soul bruised, his whole self buffeted by the black winds he feels circling the earth, his senses racked beyond themselves by an acridity of smoke, an uneasiness of rising water, a blaring of loudspeakers from those who drive fires and whose ships trade widely on spreading waters. He weeps for the world he once uttered into being. He weeps for the disarticulation of his vision, for the self become solitary, for us and them. Weeps for his am become it, for the hawk forlorn on the cliff, the salmon twisting desperately in rivers no longer familiar. Weeps for sun, moon, and stars calculated to an abyss. Knowing, however, no other words, he steps onto the shore once again begins.
And that's Paddy Bush with his poem Amargin 2022, which is part of his new book, The Amargin Step, An Exploration in the Imagination of Ivre. One thing I did wonder about, Paddy, obviously Skellig Vichil is all part of what you're talking about in the Skelligs. You were talking about the Bay of Skelligs, Skelligs Bay there to us earlier on. Do you see the use of Skellig Vichil, the recent use of it in the whole Star Wars saga? Do you see that as in some ways part of a mythology, or does it annoy you?
I'm afraid it may well become part of a mythology, but I'm afraid it annoyed me, particularly because of the secrecy with which it was done, the lack of consultation with the OPW who are running the place, with the UNESCO, with the Heritage Council, with the government's own advisory group about Skellig. None of these were consulted. There was a secret deal done by the Department of Arts with the Irish Film Board and Disney with 3 or 4 days public notice of what was happening. I might read 4 lines I wrote about that in anger at the time. Is that okay?
Yeah, go ahead. Ask Skellig, yeah.
Skellig Vihil Erek Serdil Tri Chamastil Yoli and Starcha Achuli Gurunda O Chorum and Duchish Ersan Skillini Suracha Star Wars. You know, I think it's not beyond the bounds of possibility that places like that can be used for commercial filming, but it shouldn't be done in a secret deal.
Yeah, you'd want more openness and transparency about the whole thing. However, one thing I know you're not angry about, and one man you're not at all angry about, and his association with Ivre, is Daniel O'Connell and Derry Nam.
Indeed. I think, when I moved with my family to Ivre just over 50 years ago, I gradually learned, for me, for other people it might be different, but for me, the big stories were the Milesian landing, Skellig, and by extension Finan and lots of other early Christian remains. And then what I thought of first as Daniel O'Connell, but again, got to learn that Daniel O'Connell was merely the product of a long literary family. There was a distant ancestor in Cromwellian times, wrote a marvellous poem called Tirivnahern. There was his aunt, Eileen Duvney Connell, who composed Queen Arthi Lera, his grandmother, Maureen Igriv, who is famous in lots of folklore poetry, and indeed a daughter who wrote a book and particularly a long poem called Derry Nan in 1832, Ellen O'Connell, who was actually named after Eileen Dove. And two of his sons wrote poetry that was published in The Nation. So he belonged to a long literary tradition and used that facility with words in his own political rhetoric.
And indeed, in fact, you go in great depth into the works of Ellen, the daughter. How striking are they for you? They are very much in the 19th century tradition in terms of what she does. But what stands out in the quality of what she has written for you, Paddy?
Well, particularly the long poem Derry Nan in 1832, because it in its couple of hundred lines, it presents a topographical picture of Derry Nan, which is quite accurate. You can guide yourself on two wonderful walks in the areas, but it also presents her father. She mentions him as being the conqueror of Wellington. In other words, that Wellington was forced to concede Catholic emancipation. But at the same time and in the same breath, she talks about the conqueror of Wellington being wound around their fingers by his grandchildren, presumably her own grandchildren or her own children. And this was published in 1832 at the height of an election which was very, very important to Daniel O'Connell, and he was in fact joined by two sons and two sons-in-law after that election. So it was a kind of, here's your, conqueror of Wellington at home. It was almost like a Hello magazine portrait of O'Connell. You know, it was politically very, very shrewd. And her own husband was one of the MPs elected in that 1832 election.
You also mentioned Paddy Eileen Dubhne Connell and, of course, her Queena Art Alaire, as you said, that she composed, which is a much better way of putting it in terms of than that she wrote, which is there in, you have a new translation of the poem in the back, and an appendix to the book as well, The Howl for Art O'Leary. It sounds to me as if that kind of literary keening aspect of things was something you wanted to bring out in this new translation.
Yes, I do think of it as a howl, you know, and there are these incredibly dramatic things like her palming up her dead husband's blood and drinking it, which is a motif from early Irish literature. But there's this unrestrained grief combined with a very, very literary ability to control language.
Yeah, very courtly, very courtly in the way it's done. Paddy, thanks for speaking to us about the book this evening.
Thank you very much indeed.
That's Paddy Bush speaking to us about The Amargan Step, an exploration in the imagination of Ivra, and it is published by Dingle Publishing, and that is our lot for this Tuesday evening. Leah Murphy researched, Jimmy Doyle was on sound this evening, Ollie Hamilton was the broadcast coordinator, and tonight's programme was produced by Kay Sheehy. Back with you tomorrow night, 7 o'clock, here on RT Radio 1. John Creedon will be with you after the news.